Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. A couple of decades ago, a landmark book titled The Emerging Democratic Majority predicted that America was on its way to a bright blue future, thanks to an inevitable demographic shift that would deliver the party a dominant, durable political coalition. In fact, Barack Obama's overwhelming victory in 2008 was seen as ultimate proof of this theory, that demographics was destiny, that this coalition would allow Democrats to dominate the Electoral College well into the future. But then Trump happened, and his victory not only blew up that coalition, it highlighted the rising power of negative partisanship, with anti-Trump sentiment, quite rightly, becoming a unifying force for Democrats. This raises an essential question. If you were to peel back opposition to Trump and Trumpism, what truly defines the Democratic Party today? And with the Republican Party infected with extremism and embarrassingly unable to govern, why aren't Democrats winning sustainable majorities? Why is the Democratic Party losing ground with some of the core parts of the coalition that was supposed to guarantee its political dominance? Now, 20 years later, the authors of that famous book are answering exactly that question in a new book. Where have all the Democrats gone? The soul of the party in the age of extremes. In this two-part series, we're going to get right to the heart of the Democratic Party's identity crisis and its electoral vulnerabilities and opportunities with the one and only Rui Teixeira. Rui was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress for nearly two decades, and he's now a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a leading expert in the transformation of party coalitions and the future of American politics. Rui holds a PhD and MS in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's appeared on CBS News, CNN, NPR, MSNBC, and PBS, and has published in The Atlantic, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. He's also the co-editor of The Liberal Patriot on Substack. This turned out to be a very long conversation, so we're putting it out in two parts. Here in part one, Rui and I discuss the Democratic Party's struggle to win sustainable majorities and why that's more than just a messaging problem or the result of Fox News. We talk about the changing party coalitions and how the Democrats became the party of the elites and the corresponding shift in priorities away from the concerns of working class voters and toward those of a more liberal base of college educated elites. We talk about their untenably relaxed posture on immigration and how that hasn't translated to more support among Hispanic voters. In fact, they're trending the opposite direction. And we talk generally about how alignment with culturally radical positions is alienating working class voters. Then in part two, which will be out next Wednesday, we dive into some specific areas, like the shift toward identity politics and how it's changing the party's approach to race and civil rights. We talk about radical approaches to transgender rights, the change in environmental policy from responsible stewardship to the more extreme positions of the Green New Deal. Then we get into the rise in independent voters, what it really means, and how it should impact political strategy. And finally, whether it's even possible for structural reforms in our political system to improve the health of our democracy. And now here's part one of my discussion with Rui Teixeira. Rui, welcome back to Politicology.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ron. This should be a very interesting conversation at a very interesting time.
So before we dive into the book, which, as I mentioned, I just finished reading over the weekend, so it's all very fresh for me. Why don't we remind listeners about where you're coming from, your career, what led you to writing this book?
Okay. Obviously, I have an academic background, but I did go into kind of the think tank world. And as things evolved, I wound up at the Center for American Progress, really when it started, which was 2003, which became sort of the premier and most well-funded center-left think tank. I wrote, as I was coming into that organization, coming out of the Century Foundation, another liberal foundation, I wrote a book called America's Forgotten Majority, Why the White Working Class Still Matters. That's been a continuing theme of mine in my writings, is try to apprise people on the center left of the realities of the American electorate and how important, for example, working class voters, especially white working class voters, still are. Now, in 2002, I wrote a more well-known book with John Judis called The Emerging Democratic Majority. And in that book, we sort of took stock of all the changes that were happening in the American political terrain, demographic, ideological, economic. And we basically thought that those changes were creating a playing field that was favorable for the Democrats and that they could conceivably build a dominant majority on, since their kind of politics was probably closer to where the country was moving than the Republicans. And that if they played their cards right and practiced a sort of progressive centrism, they might do very well indeed. But back to the first book I mentioned, we actually made a big point in the Emerging Democratic Majority of reminding people, hey, look, the white working class is still a huge demographic. It's 45% of the country at the time. You can't afford to lose too many votes in that sector. If the Democrats continued to lose altitude among that group, the whole political arithmetic is thrown off. You needed to, keep about 40% of that vote, maybe nationwide, 45 in some of the key Rust Belt states where the white working class vote looms so large. And just generally, trying to make people understand that nothing's automatic about these changes. They won't automatically deliver a sustainable majority. It has to be, done in the right kind of way with some smart strategy and politics. Now, in 2008, when Obama gets elected in that sort of landslide, winds up with the trifecta, if you look at the underlying support he got in that election, and it did sort of look like what we talked about came true. Because we talked about in the book about the rise of the non-white population, the realignment of professionals to the Democrats, the transformation of the women's vote, the dominance of dynamic metropolitan areas we called ideopolises in a lot of areas of the country that are changing the politics of a lot of key states. And all of that seemed to be in line with how Obama did. However, 2010, everything comes crashing down. The Democrats lose 63 seats. Obama does manage to get reelected in 2012. One thing happened in 2012 that reflected the way people misinterpreted 2008 as well is, there was a really important role for the white working class in both of those victories. And in fact, Obama doesn't come back and win in 2012 without grabbing some of those white working class voters back that the Democrats lost in 2010 in the upper Midwest. Completely disregarded. And after 2012, the basic mantra of the Democratic Party seems to become, despite getting their ass kicked in 2014, rising American electorate, the coalition of the ascendant. We've got this. We're on our way. The important thing is just to press our foot to the accelerator, make sure our voters get to the polls, and everything will work out. Well, in 2016, it didn't. John Judas and I were watching some of these developments and sort of shaking our head. And I was doing this even while I was at the Center for American Progress, trying to remind people, look, American politics is so much more complicated than you think. There's so many other moving parts here. We don't have this. In fact, there's key weaknesses in the Democratic coalition that can really come back to bite you. And in 2016, of course, that does happen. Trump does well enough in the Midwest, swinging a lot of white working class voters his way enough to get the election. And really, 2016 is a bit of a cut point, both for my work at the American Progress and, our thinking between John Judas and myself, because it was very apparent that after that election, the way that election was summed up by people in and around the Democratic Party, the dominant interpretation was, this is all about racial resentment and xenophobia, status threat. It's completely ununderstandable why anyone would vote for Donald Trump unless they were motivated by these reactionary sentiments. And therefore, what could you do? we're the Democratic Party. We're the Progressive Party. We can't worry too much about appealing to those kinds of voters. And I thought that was a big mistake, that in fact, this working class sized hole that was appearing in the Democratic coalition getting worse fundamentally compromised their ability to form a dominant majority, fundamentally compromised too the kind of party they were and they were becoming. And I think we saw that strengthen throughout the teens, and we see it in the early 20s as well. That flash forward to some of the themes of the book, the Democrats have increasingly become the party of liberalish college-educated elites and much less the party of the working class. And we saw that especially in 2020 and forward, when Democrats not only continue to get crushed among the white working class, but they're significantly and steadily losing altitude among non-white working class voters, particularly Hispanic working class voters. So that's some of the developments that led me to question where the Democrats were coming from, questioning the whole orientation of the Center for American Progress, which, like other left-leaning institutions, became increasingly insular, increasingly dogmatic, increasingly singing from the same hymn book all the time, hashtag resistance, all that jazz. And they just seemed to lose interest in a lot of the ways that American politics was really working itself out, and losing interest, I thought, in working class voters writ large. And I just couldn't take it anymore. So I had always gotten along with the people at the American Enterprise Institute because they're smart conservatives, and I never hated conservatives the way a lot of my colleagues did. You know, I never viewed them as handmaidens of Satan. I thought they were, you know, people at different point of view, and I was going to argue with them and we could have a discussion. But, you know, it turned out I couldn't have a discussion anymore at the Center for American Progress, but I could have one at the American Enterprise Institute, which, it, to its credit, remains an actual think tank where people do actual thinking and they write books and they're actual scholars. I mean, they're mostly center right, clearly, but hey, that's okay. You know, we're all entitled to our point of view so long as we can discuss those points of view. So I find it a much more congenial atmosphere than I found at the Center for American Progress. And indeed, that I observed throughout the sort of left infrastructure, which, as I say, became increasingly insular and closed in itself.
Well, I'm no stranger to what can happen when you tell inconvenient truths to your own tribe that they really don't want to hear. I want to go back to that point you made about 2016 as sort of a turning point, because this paragraph stuck out to me in the book, which really chafes at the narrative about Trump voters. You're writing, while some Trump voters in 2016 were highly reactionary, there was a couple of political scientists who showed that Trump's improvement over Romney was primarily attributable to increased support among voters with racially moderate views. Trump's voters were actually less xenophobic, less sexist, had lower levels of racial resentment, and were more tolerant on average than Romney's supporters. Clinton's loss revealed the weaknesses in the Democrats' vision of the new American majority. Can you explain, maybe some of the numbers would help, if you can recall, paint that picture for us, and why we came away from 2016 with the idea that this was all down to race? Why did Democrats come away with that idea? And sort of how did it get so entrenched in the dogmatism that you described at CAP?
Well, between 2012 and 2016, an inconvenient thing happened for that whole thesis about racial resentment. Basically, it went down between those two points. So it makes it an implausible nominee for driving that whole 2016 election. Another thing that's important about racial resentment, so-called, is that it's based in a scale that political scientists like to use that includes questions like Irish and Italians worked their way up without any special favors. Black people should do the same. And there's a few other questions like that. Now, if you think about what that question asks or that statement says, it's basically a generic conservative view of the avenues to upward mobility, that people should get ahead without special favors. Now, it isn't endorsing discrimination. It's just a point of view about social mobility. But that scale is in an sort of uncomplicated way used to indicate racism among sort of ordinary people. And the reason why they do that is because if you ask questions that are actually about what we might have think of traditionally as racism, you don't get almost any people at all because the country's changed so much. So political scientists landed on this as implicit racism. Now, one problem with this is that if you look at the actual scale and you substitute Lithuanians or Nepalese for blacks, you get basically the same responses. Ryan Enos forget the first name of the guy named Carney, they did an experiment where they verified this, that in fact this is the case. So really what it has to do with is, in a sense, called just world belief, as they termed it, rather than racism per se, or at least you could certainly question the extent to which it's indicated racism. But that scale, this gets back to the empirics of that election in 2016 and why people convinced themselves so rapidly. Well, besides the fact Trump was a obviously a screwy guy who did say a lot of racist things, right? But he also talked about trade. He talked about runaway shops. He talked about immigration. He talked about how the elites hate you and they're destroying your communities. He talked about a lot of things, but people fixated on the idea it must all be about race. But if you looked at the individual level data from the 2016 election, what was true is that there was a stronger relationship in a regression model between, you know, your level of racial resentment and your likelihood of voting for the Republican candidate, particularly it had a relationship to Obama to Trump voting. So, but that's not an accounting exercise. And this is where Marble and Grimmer come in, whose research I was quoting there. They show that, yeah, okay, well, that's true about the regression model, but if you actually try to account for the additional votes that Trump actually obtained in 2016 relative to Romney, it didn't explain anything. And in fact, where those votes came from was from a far different pool of voters than people think of when they think about the idea, oh, racial resentment drove the 2016 election. So Marble and Grimmer were able to show that the conventional story about these voters and how they were all deplorables was completely wrong. But, you know, I don't think that's the way most Democrats summed it up. They gobbled up all the regression studies about the role of racial resentment. In the process, I might add, and this is something that always astounds me, Ron, that this is a party that spent 40 years talking about the depredations of neoliberalism, how it's destroying communities, how the rich don't care about you, how the whole model that we run our economy on is broken and it's crushing working class people of all races. And then in 2016, they completely forgot about it. It's like the only reason why anyone would vote for a fire-breathing populist like Donald Trump who denounced the elites was because they're racist. And I thought this was ridiculous. I mean, especially if you look at the geographic pattern of where Trump got those votes and where the Obama and Trump flippers were. It was all in these areas that had declined relative to the overall economic progress of the United States and were dependent on resource extraction, manufacturing, some of the parts of the farming sector, and so on. So to me, it was just astounding that immediately people would forget about something they've been talking about for decades and actually would make fun of the idea. Remember this whole shtick, you know, like economic anxiety. We know that has nothing to do with it. It's all about racism. So, I mean, I couldn't believe it. But that was definitely what took over, hegemonized the Democratic mind. And I dissented from that. And I tried to make those points within the Center for American Progress and within the general left discourse. But trust me on this, nobody was listening. They did not want to hear it.
Was there some motivated reasoning going on there? Was this just purely an innocent misreading of the data?
Oh, clearly there's motivated reasoning. I mean, look at the way the whole Democratic Party was evolving in terms of its attitudes toward race and gender and other hot button issues, getting more and more liberal over time. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement started in 2013, right? And by the time Hillary was running against Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primaries, she was, you know, basically tripling down on identity politics to sort of push people away from Bernie Sanders' class-oriented point of view. I mean, she would say, you know, if we ended, we broke up the big banks tomorrow, would it end racism? If we taxed the billionaires tomorrow, would it end sexism? If we did this and that, would it stop transphobia? So she was very consciously trying to attack Bernie Sanders from the left and putting her chips down on the whole rise of identity politics within the Democratic Party, which, of course, in a primary election is even more important, much more important than it is in a general election, because the people who vote in primaries and pay attention to them are disproportionately the very college-educated, liberalish people who are increasingly vital part of the Democratic coalition and become increasingly liberal on all these issues. But of course, that's not, very importantly, where working-class people are coming from by and large, particularly white working-class people. But as I say, increasingly non-white working-class people who just, you know, don't feel like they really want to or need to sign up with a lot of these boutique cultural issues to be, you know, quote, progressive, unquote.
Yeah, I think there's, especially about non-white working class voters, there's been a low refrigerator hum of acknowledgement, especially recently, the Democratic Party is struggling with that demographic. There's also a lot of people within the party yelling about how it isn't really happening and a lot of people ignoring the signs. We've talked about this a fair amount on this podcast. Can you give us a sense of what the 2020 election and the 2020 midterms showed about support for Democrats, because those two elections in particular have been held up as evidence that there's nothing really to worry about here.
Right. Nothing to see here. Yeah. Well, in 2020, I mean, it is incontrovertible, and I think most people acknowledge that at this point, that there was a very substantial fall off in support among non-white voters for Democrats, particularly non-white working class voters. If you look at the sort of gold standard catalyst data, the Democrats' advantage among Hispanic non-college voters declined by 20 points between the two elections. That's a lot. And it happened all over the country. It happened with all kinds of Hispanic working class voters. So that, you know, that is, you know, uncontrovertible, I think, about that election. Now, of course, Democrats, Biden managed to squeak through, so what's the problem? And I think that there was sort of a evolving view among, you know, about the 2020 election that, well, you know, even these Hispanic working class voters, they're the more conservative ones who showed up, and we didn't do a good job of getting our Hispanics to the poll. And sort of a lot of hand-waving about it doesn't really mean what you think it means, i.e. they're losing non-white working class voters. Now, in 2022, 2023, we see the Democrats do well in midterms and special elections. And I think there's an increasing consensus among not the hack analysts, but the real analysts, that a big part of this performance has to do with the ability, the way the Democrats coalition is now purpose-built for low turnout elections. I mean, these are like great for the current Democratic Party coalition, which no longer is hurt by low turnout. It's helped because the very people who show up in these kinds of elections who are motivated to vote in less high turnout elections are the most educated, most engaged part of the population. And they have become so heavily Democratic or Democratic leaning that, in fact, you're actually in pretty good shape if turnout is low. In fact, the lower it is, arguably, the better it is for you. Which, of course, a complete reverse of the way people used to think about the Democratic and Republican parties, that Democrats are, in fact, you know, hurt by low turnout. Well, not anymore. Okay, so what we're looking for as we go to 2024 is we'll have a lot more peripheral voters who show up in the voting poll. All the data show that peripheral voters, people who didn't vote in 2022, 2023, people who voted in 2020, but not in 2022, all of these voters are in fact more conservative, less ideological, more inclined to give Trump a listen, and not in the wheelhouse of, you know, the currently existing Democratic Party. And that's what the polls are showing now, right? If you look, for example, at the Democrats' advantage among Hispanics, now it's averaging in the low, you know, the high single digits, right? 8-9 points. That's a disastrous fall off from where they were in 2020, which in turn would be a disastrous fall off from 2016. So something's going on here. We see black voters, particularly black male voters, voting for or saying they're going to vote for Trump at relatively high rates compared to historical patterns. So all of this stuff is going on. And the way Democrats sort of wave that away is, well, you know, That's the people who are answering polls right now. The only poll that really counts is the hoary old, you know, trope. The only poll that counts is on election day. And on election day, you know, people realize the choice between Trump and Biden, which is now coming into focus. You know, they'll stop sort of casting, in a sense, protest votes through how they respond to polls. We'll actually have our mobilization, you know, going on 10, all 8 cylinders, and everything will turn out okay. Well, maybe, but the simplest interpretation of bad polling data is it's bad. The simplest interpretation of you're running, you know, 10 or 15 points behind where you were in 2020 among Hispanic voters is you are running 10 or 15 points behind. And therefore, maybe you need to actually figure out a way to get those voters to give you a, you know, give you a look, change their minds. You have to persuade them. And one thing Democrats have lost interest in an odd sort of way is persuasion. They don't seem to have a lot of faith that they can convert people who are now toying with Trump or the Republicans into Democrats by persuasion, by convincing them the things they're told about the Democrats aren't true, that they are, you know, tough on immigration and crime, that they do care about inflation or whatever. I mean, you know, I'm not saying any of this is easy to convert voters who are now toying with Trump into Democratic voters, but, you know, at least focus on the target here, which is to change their minds, not just like assume they won't show up.
Yeah. It's either persuasion or mobilization. And when mobilization is your only
your only objective, especially in low turnout. If the physics of low turnout elections have completely changed, then you have to focus on persuasion, and they're not doing that.
Yeah, that's my view, that at least they're not doing very well. I mean, I think reluctantly they have to engage after a while, but I think they prefer a story that's more comforting, which is that everything will turn out all right in the end, provided we, you know, turn everything up to 12 in our rhetoric and press the mobilization accelerator.
Okay, I want to spend plenty of time on several big issue areas where Democrats, you argue, especially need to do that. Before we do, I want to just talk about this term shadow parties that you introduce in the book, because I think it's particularly useful. There are groups that make up both Republican and Democratic shadow parties. Who are they? How do they operate? And specifically, has the Democratic shadow party changed from the Carter era to now, which you trace very well in the book?
Right. Well, I mean, back in the day, back in Jimmy Carter's day, the Democratic Party, if it had a shadow party, it wasn't the kind of shadow party we have today, but, you know, more, you know, sort of labor-oriented intellectuals and labor itself. All right. Labor used to be really important in setting the tone for the Democratic Party and culture. No more. That really has disappeared very significantly over time. And what we have, what has grown up in the latter part of the 20th century and sort of into the 21st, is this penumbra of, you know, foundations, activists, you know, nonprofit groups, advocacy groups, huge chunks of academia, huge chunks of the media, very influential intellectuals who have a certain point of view on what the Democratic Party should be. And that's where the money is, you know, to a large extent. I mean, that's where the influence is. That's where the discourse is. I mean, one way I think about it, Ron, is basically educated elites who are lean liberal on a lot of these issues that I'm sure we'll get into. They control the commanding heights of cultural production in this country. They're the ones who set the tone for good, honest, decent people who are Democrats in terms of how they think about the world. And they have a huge influence on politicians. They have a huge influence on primary voters. They have a huge influence on the image of the Democratic Party, how it's perceived by ordinary voters. Their voices are very loud. And of course, one thing that's totally turbocharged this rise of the shadow party, besides the money and influence behind it, is social media. I mean, that has provided an avenue through which the shadow party and the activists associated with it and the groups associated with it can put pressure on the Democratic Party and on politicians to toe the line and in a sense, control the discourse. So that influence of the shadow party takes the Democrats away from its historic connections to and commitment to the working class, because a lot of the shadow party writ large, that's not their priority. There are many, many issues that parts of the shadow party are committed to that are not about helping the working class, or not even necessarily about winning elections. I mean, they're basically very committed to the vector of values and issues that they think are really important, and devil take the hindmost. And the Democratic Party is their vehicle for bringing those things to fruition. And that's really their priority, not the party as a whole, and certainly not the working class. So I think that's made a huge difference in the Democratic Party's image to ordinary voters. And I think it's made a big difference in how Democrats prioritize issues and what they sort of spend their political capital on. And that's the world in which we live today, where the Democrats are, to a significant extent, hugely influenced by their shadow party. And their shadow party is just very, very far to the left of the median voter. And that makes a difference.
I think to the ears of many Democrats listening, the idea that the Democratic Party is the party of white, educated, affluent elites is really alienating. But that is more and more the case. I just wonder if that's the way rank and file Democratic voters are seeing themselves now, or if there's an inherent contradiction in the way Democratic voters see themselves versus the way these elite institutions and the Democratic Party seems to be going.
Well, I think you're getting at there the idea, and it's true, that there's a difference between what the shadow party thinks and what liberal politicians like Pramila Jayapal, who's from a plus 67D Democratic district in Seattle, what they think about the world, or what the people who ran in the 2020 Democratic primary most of them seem to think about the world and what they needed to appeal to. There's a difference between that and what an ordinary middle or working class Democratic voter thinks, which is to say, yeah, they're more liberal than their counterpart who's associated with the Republican Party, but they aren't nearly as liberal as the people who drive the Democratic discourse, who, you know, are vote in primary elections, who are the most engaged Democrats on social media. In other words, they're more moderate. If you look at, Democratic Hispanics and Blacks, they're overwhelmingly moderate to conservative. They're not liberal. Now, white college educated Democrats, they are overwhelmingly liberal. But that's different from Hispanics and Blacks. And actually, one amusing trend we've seen in American public opinion is the most racially militant voters in the United States are white college educated liberals, not Blacks or Hispanics. So, the ones who are most denouncing, structural racism and white supremacy.
The ones who want to use Latinx.
So, I mean, that's all baloney as far as most regular Black and Hispanic voters are concerned, particularly Black and Hispanic Democrats, right? Remember to fund the police and nonsense about, we need less police and more social, whatever. I mean, that was never popular among Black Hispanic voters, including among Black and Hispanic voters. But you know who was popular? Among white college-educated Democrats. So it just shows to go you that we're sort of in the upside down now, as I put it sometimes, where, the Democrats regularly dominate the college-educated and reflect their priorities, and Republicans, increasingly dominate the working class. And that's pretty weird. And I'm not saying the Republicans represent working class interests very well. I doubt that's true. And, to some extent, they're relying, obviously, on rhetoric and, sort of bashing the Democrats more than actually delivering for their constituents. But, let's face it, this is reality. A lot of working class people are increasingly having difficulty thinking of the Democrats as their party, the party that doesn't look down on them, the party that's on their side. I mean, people make a lot of visceral decisions about which party they support. And why they're not like looking at the policy, the 2020 Democratic policy platform or what's going to be the 2024 Democratic policy platform. They know very little about this stuff, but they do have a sense of the parties and where they're coming from.
Okay, let's dive into some of these issues. One of the things I found really helpful about the way you talked about these issue areas was, and I'm not sure if you did it explicitly in every single issue area, but it was certainly a clear frame, is reformers versus radicals. And maybe you can explain what you mean by the difference between reformers and radicals and the shift in the Democratic Party from sort of looking at issues through the lens of class to the lens of identity and how that's impacted voters. And then we'll get into the issues. I want to start with immigration, though.
Yeah, so we have a whole section in the book, the second section of the book called Cultural Radicalism, where we talk about the ways in which the Democrats appear to have signed on to a variety of ways on issues like race, immigration, gender, and so on that are really quite radical in a bad way and take the Democrats out of their historic wheelhouse and indeed the wheelhouse of the values of the American people. So immigration's a good example because, I mean, most people don't know this, or if they knew it, they've forgotten it, that the Democrats once had a much different attitude toward immigration than they do today. That, in the 90s with the Jordan Commission and historically up to that point, Democrats had realized there was a problem with having completely open borders and open immigration, that, having a lot of low-skill immigrants coming into the country in an uncontrolled way did put pressure on unions, put pressure on the low-wage labor market, and was generally, not something that was desirable, and that employers would exploit this underclass of undocumented or illegal workers, and that therefore we needed to actually figure out ways to tighten up the system. We needed an e-verify system so employers couldn't use illegal immigrants and pay them less and so on and so forth. And this was basically the stance of the labor movement, and it was the stance of big parts of the labor-oriented Democratic Party, which was very big at the time. What happens over time is Democrats evolve, and including parts of the labor movement like SEIU, they move away from this kind of attitude toward immigration, where they sort of start assuming that there could not possibly be any problem with immigration. As I put it, I think I stole this from David Leonhardt, the the default line became more is better and less is racist. And that evolves very strongly over the course of the 21st century. And, you know, I don't know about your neighborhood, Ron, but I see plenty of, you know, no human being is illegal. There's this sign, science is real. No, you know, I said love is love. I mean, and that is like the standard issue line of a lot of educated Democrats these days. The only reason to object to like lots of people pouring over the border from Mexico or Central America or wherever, really, is that people, you know, they just don't like black and brown people. They don't like foreigners. They just like they're troglodytes. They're not for this multicultural, multiracial America that gloriously is coming into being. There can't possibly be any other reason than this. And that is just ridiculous. I mean, the idea that nations should not control their borders and have an actual system that decides who gets in and enforce that fairly is ludicrous. This is not the way any country wants to work. National borders are there for a reason, and people feel like people coming over the border willy-nilly and basically gaming the asylum system and being paroled or whatever, that there's something kind of wrong with this. I mean, maybe these people should do it the right way. Maybe there are too many people coming. I mean, obviously, in a lot of cities, even in the north now, we see, you know, municipalities being overwhelmed with people who come in who are, you know, illegal, came over the border and now are sort of distributed across the country. This is really unpopular, really unpopular. And there's nothing progressive about the idea of open borders, right? Because it would create, you know, tremendous burdens on a nation. It does undercut the low-wage labor market. As Bernie Sanders memorably put it at one point, open borders is a Koch brothers, you know, plot or line. And of course, he backed off from that. And this just shows you the influence of the shadow party, that most of the advocacy groups basically, they're not that interested in border security. What they're interested in is comprehensive immigration reform, which basically translates to the primary thing we want to do is develop a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants who are here and been here for a while, which is a laudable ambition, but you're not going to sell that to the American people, nor should you be able to sell that to the American people unless it's combined with an actual immigration system that includes real border security, which is what people want. I mean, over and over again, this is documented in the polls, including among most Democrats, including among most Hispanics. People do not support, you know, basically de facto open borders, uncontrolled immigration. They actually want a fair, enforced system. And the evolution of the Democrats toward, you know, this sort of radicalism on the issues that sort of toys de facto de jure with open borders is a really bad, you know, development. And in fact, it's hurting the Democrats right now. And it's both bad policy and bad politics, in my opinion. And that's kind of a theme that runs through our discussion of these culturally radical issues, is they're both bad policy and bad politics. And the Democrats, by invoking these tropes, by identifying with them, they actually put a ceiling on their support and alienate themselves from working class voters. It doesn't mean they can't win elections, obviously, for reasons we've been discussing, but it does mean that they're really putting a ceiling on their ability to put together a sustainable majority. And they're, you know, as we've kind of been talking about, you know, who is the party of the working class in America today? Doesn't really look that much like the Democrats anymore. Their priorities seem to be different.
Well, there does still seem to be this belief that a more lax immigration enforcement will help Democrats perform better with Hispanic voters. But the data isn't bearing that out. Maybe you can extol that a little bit.
Well, as the Democrats have become increasingly liberal on the issue of immigration, they've simultaneously lost Hispanic support, which is a sign that these voters, their number one issue is not the people who vote in elections, right? Hispanic citizens. What are their number one issues? They're the economy, there's healthcare, there's schools, there are their communities, they're the ability to move ahead in America. It's not immigration. And the idea these are in an uncomplicated way, immigration voters, is just incorrect. And also, it really misunderstands who these voters are and what they care about. And that connected to the whole idea of them as being voters in that sense, sort of connected to the conception the Democrats increasingly bought into, which is the way to understand Hispanic voters is they're people of color, right? They're all part of this mass of non-white voters who are, you know, sort of oppressed by the fact they live in America's white supremacist society, and they're, you know, they're victims of racism every day. That's not how Hispanics think about themselves. They think about themselves as people who are trying as hard as they can to get ahead in America. Maybe they're working two jobs. They're just, you know, trying to help their families. They're patriotic. They like America. They actually like America. The idea that they were this radical, super pro-immigration, super anti-racist group is just not correct, not borne out by the data, not borne out by their political behavior. So the idea that you're going to move Hispanics more heavily in your direction by being so super liberal immigration, it just isn't borne out by the data and by the voting patterns that we've seen. I mean, again, you know, the Democrats are running like high single digit advantages among Hispanics in Trump Biden trial heats. That shouldn't happen if really what these voters are about is about, you know, huge surges of immigration coming into the United States and how great they feel about it. They don't. We've had enormous surges during the Biden administration, which they're now, you know, trying to wriggle out of. But it's been an undeniable fact that there's a big difference between the immigration patterns and the illegal immigration patterns under Trump and under Biden. There just is. People are aware of this. You know, I think most Hispanics know about it, but you know what? They're not that happy about it. I mean, I listen to focus groups with swing voters, swing Hispanic voters, who had voted for Biden in 2020 and now are thinking of not doing it or going to vote for Trump. And a continuing theme was, you know, where did all these people come from? You know, why can't they do it the right way? I mean, they're not happy about this. It doesn't like, you know, like more of their brothers and sisters are coming across the border and they're just like just happy as clams. Because again, that misunderstands what their priorities are, what they really care about. And what they care about is just much more mundane than some, you know, sort of John Lennon, imagine there's no borders kind of thing. That's not their gig, man.
Thanks for listening. As I mentioned, this is a two-part series, and part two will be out next week, where we take a tour through some specific issue areas like race and civil rights, sex and gender, environmental policy, what the rise in independent voters really means and how it should impact political strategy, and whether it's even possible for structural reforms in our political system to improve our democracy. In the meantime, I'd love to hear what this discussion sparks for you, so send me a note at podcast@politicology.com. See you in part two.